from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when an 18-year-old British man named Johan Hari visited his doctor. According to The Guardian, that morning, Johan explained how, ever since he was small, he had battled with feelings of overwhelming sadness. When he wasn't taking himself off to cry quietly, an anxious monologue would be running through his head. But Hari had convinced himself that he had to be strong and not weak and just get over his feelings of sadness. Well, his doctor was reassuring, explaining that these feelings were to be expected, since Hari was one of many people whose brain had depleted levels of serotonin. So the doctor prescribed some pills that could restore the balance. 2 decades later, Hari wondered why the doctor didn't ask more questions that day. What was his life like? What exactly was making him sad? What changes could be made to make life more tolerable? Hari's dissatisfaction with the process became the seed for his new book, just released this week. It's called Lost Connections, and it promises to reshape how we approach and treat depression. This hour, we're going to focus on one specific part of Hari's book because it's already getting a great deal of attention. Hari argues in the book, and has said in many interviews about it, that between 65 and 80% of people who go on antidepressants will relapse in the first year. That claim alone has led the first readers of the book to post their own reviews this week, saying they're now considering stopping medication. After all, it doesn't work that well, right? But here's the problem. A number of scientists have tried to dig into Hari's claims on efficacy, wondering where they're coming from. And many are now saying that's bogus. The claim of relapse comes not from science, but from a different pop psychology book. But the meta studies tend to find that somewhere around 20 to 25% of people, not 65 to 80, who go on antidepressants will have a relapse in the first year. Somewhere around double that number of people on placebo will have a relapse. Hari has responded that, look, he doesn't want the public to obsess on the numbers, but rather take a fresh look at treating depression holistically. Okay, let's talk about all of that this hour with our guests. Eric Kane is former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. It's always good to have you, Eric. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Chris Knoll is assistant professor of pharmacy practice at St. John Fisher College's Wegman School of Pharmacy. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Eleni Gogos is a mental health activist and psychology student at RIT. Eleni, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Jordan Duby, welcome back to the program. He's a mental health activist. Jordan, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
You know, Eric, I was saying before the program began, we almost never talk about books if we haven't really read them cover to cover, digested them. But in this case, there's so much buzz about this book in certain circles, with even people saying, well, maybe I'll go off meds, that I wanted to kind of just grab this head on and just talk about, we'll start with antidepressants, and then we will talk about what a multi-pronged approach to depression means. So let me start with this. When you hear him in this pop psychology book that's getting reviewed just about everywhere now, saying 65 to 80% of people go on antidepressants are going to relapse in the first year, even though the meta studies don't say that, does that worry you?
Sure, because it's inaccurate and it doesn't represent what is in a way a complex field. Whenever you use the word depression, you have to sort of begin at the notion of, well, lots of us have sadness. Lots of us have days that are, you know, dark days, or, you know, it's cloudy in Rochester, you know, it's kind of depressing. That's different from having major depression, which is a really clear clinical disorder with very specific criteria and lots known about how to treat it, and treatment's not perfect, and we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, realizing that there are also mild forms of this and moderate forms of this. Anyone who argues that you should take an approach that integrates an understanding of the person in her life or his life and what kinds of trauma or issues or other things have gone on, and as well as what medical problems may exist, because depression often keeps company with medical problems, as well as understanding that there are a wide variety of treatments, that's kind of like mom and apple pie. Yes, you should do all those things. When you come out with some sort of doctrinaire statement that, you know, gives a figure that's pseudoscientific, then that really raises concern.
And, you know, the Guardian review of Johan Hari's book said that some parts of the book seem sloppy, but the part that they highlight as compelling is the idea that Hari goes on this worldwide journey to understand depression and how it's treated around the world, and comes back with this idea that too often, not always, but too often, it's just treated with medicine and pills and nothing else. And so I'll read from the Guardian Review. Quote, "The lazy, oversimplified, and unimaginative attitudes of the medical establishment to anxiety and depression laid out in Hari's book, Beggar Belief. You could argue that finding fault in the current system isn't that hard. It's the solutions that present the real challenge. But Hari is clear about the difficulties of the task ahead, and in offering new ways of thinking presents not surefire solutions, but he says an alternative direction of travel points on a compass. Put in the broadest terms, his argument is that if our current malaise lies in disconnection from vital human requirements such as neighborliness, professional fulfillment, acknowledgement of trauma, and so on, then we need to find ways to reconnect." End quote. That doesn't seem all that new to me.
In fact, it's not new. And indeed, one of the things they start teaching you when you go into medical school, certainly here at the University of Rochester, is take a look at the person's whole life. Understand where they've come from. Appreciate the kinds of things that someone's gone through. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of work on early life trauma and how that affects people, whether you think about it at a social level, a psychological level, or a genetic level. And there's certainly an understanding that you can take all the medicine and all the psychotherapy in the world, but if someone is unsafe, a victim of violence, someone who's being traumatized now, they're not going to get better until you help, in a very concrete way, provide safety, provide shelter, provide food and the kinds of things that are real. You know, we're not going to give medicine and make some person who's a refugee fleeing from war suddenly safe. No one that I know makes that claim. Now, is there a fair critique that someone could walk into a primary care office or even a psychiatrist's office and feel like they're being treated in a med mill? Sure, there are physicians who do that. There's no question that we see that. We've talked recently about opioids and people walk in and get opioids. There's no question that there are people who don't practice up to the standards that we expect and with the aspirations that we hold for our field. But to use a big paintbrush and just, you know, sort of slop it on and say, yeah, this is the way everything is really a misrepresentation of what some really great people do day to day. And this cuts across the whole mental health field, not just psychiatry, because often meds are prescribed by primary care docs who are working with social workers and psychologists and others who, again, have taken the time and the thought to consider the person as an individual as well as to try to understand the diagnosis.
Okay. Well, let me turn to Chris Knoll, assistant professor of pharmacy practice at St. John Fisher College, about whether, you know, you would agree if Hari were here, he would probably say, okay, antidepressants are a tool in the toolkit, but they're over-relied on. Is that too broad to you?
I mean, I think that, you know, like Dr. Kane is saying, you know, you need this multifaceted approach. To his claim about the statistics where that talk about, you know, relapse and how often it happens for people who go on antidepressants, I agree with your stats where if you look at, let's say, 4 or 5 patients, you treat 4 or 5 patients with an antidepressant over about a year, maybe one of them will relapse. I think also is important to note the difference between response and remission. I think too often we prescribe a lot of these antidepressants and we're not using measurement-based care. So we're not using these evidence-based rating scales to get people to a minimal to low or no level of symptoms. And that's an important differentiation to make because when people respond to antidepressants, meaning if they only get 50% better, they're going to be much more likely to relapse. So I don't know if his statistics come from a study where they just looked at people who achieved response versus those who achieved remission, because we know those who achieve remission are much less likely to relapse. And I think that's really important.
I want to be clear for listeners that, you know, we like evidence on this program. And every single study, every time you study depression, you're going to get slightly different numbers because of the probably literally millions of variables in human composition, interactivity. But for the most part, what I'm relying on is a set of numbers compiled from meta-studies that have been compiled over the last couple of decades. And if you want, listeners, go ahead and send me an email and I'll cite you where these are coming from, because there's been a lot of conversation in the medical community about what are the actual numbers. So that's one of the reasons why we're addressing it this way. Eleni, what's your response, at least at the outset here, as a mental health activist? And I know you've got your own thoughts about antidepressants and the process of treatment. You know, what do you want to see the conversation focus on, if not, you know, whether antidepressants work or not?
Well, speaking from personal experience, I've been on various antidepressants over the years, kind of going down the regular list, you know, starting with Prozac, which is super popular to begin with, especially from primary care physicians. Personally, it took me a very, very long time to get something that I got a response to, you know, not remission. But then again, you got to look at all the different, you know, aspects, because, you know, depression sometimes can be misdiagnosed. You know, sometimes there's, you know, manic depression, bipolar, which was my case. So I did not respond to any SSRIs, antidepressants. But I do think a lot of people, at least people that I've spoken to, friends, family, kind of give me the antidepressants, you know, are just, you know, you're just adding more to your med list, and, you know, it's not good to be on meds. But I do think, you know, there is a high success rate, and it's going to be different for everyone. You're not going to pop a magic pill and it's going to go away. It could get you to your baseline. It could help you focus on what you can do to get better, you know, with a combination of therapy. I don't think taking medicine alone and antidepressants alone will, you know, be the end all. I think a combination of therapy and medication could lead you towards the right direction. But I think it's great. And I've had a few friends that have had, you know, extreme side effects. I mean, for me, you know, out of all of the ones I've tried, I've really only had a bad experience with one, like out of 10. You know, which, you know, you got to pay attention to the black box warning, you know, suicidal thoughts may increase. But, you know, that's when you have the realization and you call your doctor. You know, as for me, I keep a journal, you know, day one, day two. This is, you know, how many milligrams I'm on of what medication. This is how I'm feeling today. So, you know, you see on the commercials a lot of Cymbalta, for example. That is one I did not respond well to. So I kind of kept track, and then within the range of 5 days, when I got towards the fifth day, you feel like a different person, you know, for some people when they're reacting negatively. So for me, I kind of realized, you know, this isn't me, this is the medication speaking.
You're like the ideal patient, keeping really good track and really being introspective. I mean, it's really remarkable. How would you describe your life with medicine versus if you had no medical approach to depression?
Right. So, you know, starting from the beginning of my medicine, starting with Prozac, I did not have any response to it, but, you know, I wasn't worse. And then from there, I just kept going down the list. And generally, with the excuse of the Cymbalta, with the negative experience, which, you know, is bound to happen with so many different medicines that you're trying, because everyone's different, I've overall had a positive experience, very little side effects. You know, if anything, I have a response, not remission, but there's definitely been a response. And with a combination of therapy, it seems to be helping for me.
Okay. Jordan Duby, from your perspective as someone with PTSD, I think,
yes.
Right? What's your perspective on meds and how they've helped you or not?
Well, I've been on meds. I started on meds when I was really young. I actually can't remember, probably around third or fourth grade. And originally it was just ADHD medication. It was Adderall and completely shut down my appetite. I was concentrating a lot better, but I was also just kind of zombified. I would just sort of stare off into the distance for hours. Recess was spent just me stuck in my thoughts. Then as other traumatic issues came up, they started to medicate me for depression symptoms, and I completely lost track of everything I've been on because I'd been on things for just so long, and from such a young age that I don't remember all of the meds I've taken. I stopped around just after college. I was taking Effexor XR, and it was such a heavy medication that at the time I stopped, I was entirely numb to all the feelings that, except for the really giant emotions. So I'd go from feeling nothing at all to this explosive anger, suicidal depression, all these feelings. I'd stop sleeping. I'd be up for 24-hour periods at a time. There was one time I was even up for like 36 hours before I finally fell asleep with my eyes open. It was just a really brutal experience. After all of that, I got myself off antidepressants just to try something new because they weren't just making, they weren't being just unhelpful. They were making my life worse. And then I tried pretty much everything else. I did martial arts. I did acupuncture. I did therapy. I did Reiki. I've done mindfulness, all the things. And I found a lot of really good tools through that, through trying this on my own. And because I didn't have that medication to help balance me out, it was really intensive. I think it actually made life really, really difficult because all I had to rely on was myself and these outside toolkits of mindfulness exercises, self-soothing exercises, self-care, exercise, all these things that are supposed to be helpful. Very recently, I just started back up on Wellbutrin, and I'm finding that it's incredibly helpful to the point where I'm actually kind of reconsidering things like, man, if I just started this a couple years ago, would life have been just better?
Well, you can't change that.
No, of course not.
But why are you finding, why do you think you have a different experience this time around with medication versus in previous years?
I think in large part it's because I've spent so much time just doing therapy, just sitting through it and trying to understand my feelings and where they're coming from, especially with PTSD. Because it comes from a traumatic history, I was spent so much time trying to understand these flashbacks I was having, these triggers, these emotions, these fears and angers that are coming up from all these negative experiences that are meant to keep me safe. Hmm. And by spending that time and doing the work to try to understand where I'm coming from, I could be forgiving with myself. And now that I have a little bit of extra help with medication, it means my baseline's a lot higher than it is without it. So I'm feeling a lot more stable. And when something does come up, when I am triggered, I can handle it better than I used to be able to because I have all these tools that I've developed through 10 years of therapy along with medical help. So I'm sort of, if I talked to myself as an 18-year-old now, I would have super disagreed with myself because 18-year-old me hated antidepressants.
So there's a lot there. But Eric Kane, number one, that sounds like a great endorsement for antidepressants as part of a multi-pronged approach.
Sure. Well, it goes back to trying to understand what's going on with a person who walks in the door. I'm saying that from the physician's point of view.
Yeah.
There are some people, and I've certainly seen this, who life looks to be pretty good. They may have a positive family history of depression. Over a period of months, they see themselves changing, who respond wonderfully well to actually rather limited doses of antidepressants. There are others who clearly, you know, you're, as Lenny was saying, you know, you're in your third or fourth kind of trial, and you've taken them out to, 10, 12, 14 weeks before you switch, and given what you would think is the maximum useful dose, before they find a medication to which they respond. You know, the National Institute of Mental Health finally, after many years, did a real-world study like this. It was called STAR-D. That's the acronym for it, but literally STAR hyphen, or that little ampersand star like D. And you can go on their website, and actually I sent that to mm-hmm. you just before the show. You can go on their website, and they'll explain how they went through level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4, because they were actually trying to capture what happens in the real world. And in the real world, you know, not everybody responds to an antidepressant in the first time around. It may not fit. They may have side effects, and you may have to go to a second or add something else. One of the problems with the scientific literature is what you call publication bias. And publication bias is you tend to publish all the positive studies. So in both the what we call pharmacotherapy or drug therapy literature and in the psychotherapy literature, there was always this tendency to publish all the positive studies and not the negative ones. People started going back and realizing, well, you know, look, there are, you know, pharmaceutical companies didn't always want to release their data, but they were eventually able to go into the FDA websites and find things. And when they start looking, it realizes that depression, as we think about it, is very heterogeneous, very different among people. And you've really got to work with the person to figure out what's best for the person who I'm sitting with. And it could be anything from meds alone, psychotherapy alone, to a combination. You're really trying to understand what the person's been through, what is the reality of someone's life like right now. You know, if a person's going through a divorce, it's not like the medication is going to make the divorce any better. It may make it situation so someone can think through the challenges they're facing right now, but it isn't going to make the reality of life going away. If someone's had trauma, it isn't going to make the trauma go away.
So can I just jump in with two quick questions here? Because what you're describing here is the kind of questions that the author of the book, Lost Connections, said he didn't get at the age of 18. So if he, in fact, went to a doctor and the doctor said, you got low serotonin, we've got meds for this, but wasn't asking those questions, was that, you know, sort of a letdown in the system?
Well,
first of all.
Well, also, you know, I have to really understand, and Chris can talk to this as well, you know, the serotonin theory is just that. It's a theory. It was what you could measure at the time that these drugs came out. You know, there are a lot of other neurobiological underpinnings that we don't know about still, or we can't measure well. So whenever you had, you know, years ago when I was in training, it was the norepinephrine theory of depression or the noradrenaline. Then it was the serotonin theory. Now there are other neurochemicals. That's actually more speaks to what they could measure in the laboratory than what they actually knew the drug did in the head. So, you know, sure, you can try a medication, but you should really very quickly be assessing in days and weeks, how's this person responding? What are the side effects? 4 to 6 weeks, you should be seeing some substantial response, maybe not it all going away, the term remission, but the idea that someone is improving should be visible.
Okay, and this is where Matt on Twitter says, Evan, please clarify what relapse means with regards to clinical depression. Can we define relapse?
Sure, you're back in the swamp that you were in before.
So it's self-described by the patient, though.
Right. Well, but it's also, it could be a change in their sleep cycle, their appetite, their energy, their memory, their thinking processes, their suicidal thinking. Some people become constipated. I mean, their whole body rhythm. The term depression in some ways is not a very good term for a diagnosis that is really made up of a real description of a cluster of both things that can be observed, signs, as we would call it in medicine, and symptoms, things that are experienced subjectively. And what we call major depression has really got all those things wrapped up. And this can be caused by a thyroid deficiency. It could be caused by other kind of brain trauma. It can be caused by cancers, as well as, you know, when there's no apparent physical process. And, you know, when we think it in the severe end, it is changes in brain function, but it's also changes in behavior and how you think.
And so for the patients, you know, looking at maybe one of the good aspects to come from Hari's book, again, if you're just joining us, someone you know, whether it's you, a loved one, family, we all know people with depression. Someone may put this book in front of them. It's called Lost Connections. It's out this week. And some people are already saying, hey, I think I'll go off meds based on this. And what we're hearing from our panel is, don't go through life thinking that meds are going to solve everything, but also maybe don't just get off meds because of the claims in this book. So that's
well, if you want to have a really good way to relapse, right? A surefire way to relapse. It's someone who's responded to antidepressants. Oh, you know, they're half year in or something, and they're doing really well, and they decide, I'm doing really well. I'm going to stop these today and not take any more.
We all know people, though.
Yeah, we've all seen people. That's a really surefire way to kick someone in the seat of the pants, as it were, because of how the body's adjusted to taking what's a powerful drug.
Sure.
These are powerful medications.
But can't we also decide that if you are a patient and you don't feel like you're being treated as anything other than the pill mill that Johann Hari describes in the book, in other words, if they're not asking you those questions, if you don't feel like you're being treated holistically, can you advocate for yourself?
You bet. You should challenge your physician or your clinicians, because if it's
okay,
a team. And I've always said, go somewhere else if you're not getting the care you want.
Okay. So, Eleni, I kind of half jokingly said you're like the ideal patient because, you know, you had to go through multiple efforts to find medication that worked for you. You know, I know people in my own life who they say, okay, I'll go on medication. They go on one, it doesn't really work, and they say, see, it doesn't work. We've all sort of seen that. I've done it myself with migraine medication. So I'm not a great patient when it comes to migraines. Well, this doesn't work for me. I guess I won't take medication. What do you think is different about
Should
you?
Should we send you to some other therapist?
I think that's me. What do you think is different about you, Eleni? And do you talk to friends who have depression who struggle with that too? Well, this doesn't work for me, so, quote, meds don't work, as opposed to this particular one doesn't work.
Right. I've spoken to many friends, and you got to keep in mind not to get discouraged because it's not, you know, say Effexor is working for one of my friends. It's not necessarily going to work for me. And the trial, you know, takes so long, 4 to 6 weeks, 8 weeks. So it can be a very long process. And while you're upping your dose and then changing to a completely different medicine, if you're not responding, it can be very discouraging and frustrating. So, like I said, a lot of people have stopped after that. But it turns out, as for me, you know, I had a bad experience and then I kept going, and it got increasingly better. Like I said, and like you were saying also, you know, you gotta advocate for yourself. There are a lot of physicians that are, you know, mostly med-based and just kind of go down the list, unfortunately, based on, you know, what they've studied and not really listening to you as a person, like we were talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the case for me. It was kind of like in and out, 10 minutes, you know, not really putting in any talk therapy there, which, you know, what worked for me in the end after, you know, switching providers. You got to listen to my life history. You know, I went through what I went through as a kid and trauma and my adolescent years and college, and all of those things are important personality-wise. And then as well as for me, I, like I said, keeping a journal about meds, but I also have a mood tracker and I use paper, pen. I have an app, you know, to kind of write down, you know, how much water did I drink today? What did I eat today? It makes a difference. How much exercise did I get? And I track my moods. So it brings up kind of a graph of, you know, how is my mood, you know, going up and down during these days? Has it been increasingly low? Has it been increasingly high? Sleep, I got a sleep graph, and then I bring that with me to my appointment. And it's a little easier for the physician to kind of assess that and choose which specific medication might work.
Was this all your idea? Did someone ask you to do it?
No, this was my idea. That's the best way for me to kind of assess myself, just because I'm very organized, and I've been suggesting this to friends. It's really helped, rather than kind of going through the trials versus, you know, I think these things might work for me based on my habits and traits. So, you know, kind of even I've made suggestions to my physician.
I think it's great because, again, when you know someone who is struggling with depression and then decides I'll give you an example. I know someone in my own family who does exactly what Eric describes. Either says, you know, well, I'm strong enough, I don't need medication, or goes on medication and says, it's been a good 18 months, I'm good now, I don't need it anymore. Sometimes it takes support of people around them. And so, Eleni, you're talking about your own experience, but also sharing with your friends, here's how I've tracked it. Because I now imagine friends and family who decide, I'm going to go on medication. And then that gives them a little hope. Maybe this will work. But that first one doesn't work. And that might plunge them even further and say, nothing is going to work. Well, that's where you step in as a support group member and saying, may not work on the first time, may not work on the second time. I think that's so important, just the way you approach that and sharing that with others. And I hope people are listening to that who may be having that frustration, because Eleni's approach took some time.
It took quite a long time, but it was worth it. And you learn more about yourself, and your physician learns more about yourself, about you. And kind of sometime, you know, you're going to have to switch physicians eventually. You know, I feel like no one ever sticks with one physician or psychiatrist. And for me, you know, I do my research. Based on how I've been doing and how I am and my life events, you know, I've made suggestions before, and typically those suggestions work because I know myself as a person. So you shouldn't be afraid to kind of ask these questions. Ask, what are the side effects? Just ask for yourself, mm-hmm. and, you know, don't be afraid to turn down an option that they've given you.
All right, so we're late for our only break, but Mickey in Rochester, we're going to come to you right after the break, and we'll take some calls and feedback. We've got some questions that have come via email. Mickey wants to talk about holistic focus, which is some of what Jordan Duby was talking about, so we'll plow that territory a little bit more when we come back. We're talking about treating depression and everything from antidepressants to a holistic approach with our guest. You just heard Eleni Gogos. Barrios, who is a mental health activist and psychology student at RIT. Jordan Duby is also a mental health activist, sharing his story. Eric Kane, the former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester. And Chris Knoll, assistant professor of pharmacy practice at St. John Fisher College's Wegman School of Pharmacy. To your phone calls and emails after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, Grammy Award-winning musician Kate Lee, a Webster graduate, back in Rochester this week to teach students and also to play a show with the O'Connor Band at the Eastman Theater tomorrow night. Last year, the O'Connor Band with Kate Lee won the Grammy for Best Bluegrass Album. You're going to hear some of their music, and we'll talk about her musical journey from Rochester to Nashville and beyond. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mickey in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Mickey. Hi, Mickey. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Hi, yes. Hi, Lenny. It's Nikki. I just want to applaud both of the young people there for being just strong advocates for themselves and getting the word out. I am a psych nurse, and I've seen a lot of young people who have just given up. And it does take sometimes several years to get the right meds, the right diagnosis. And to hear their stories is so refreshing for them to be actually involved in the care. It goes to the center of the patient home, centered home that we are looking for, which they need, because it requires a lot of support. And it's not anything that they can do on their own. It isn't. And, you know, and we've had people who, because, you know, our oldest antidepressant is like 60 years old, not even, that have been, you know, in our facility since the 70s, unable to get past because their diagnosis has taken so long. They've gone through so many meds that they're institutionalized. And I think that these young people, they are able to get out here and live in the community and be functional and be able to tell their stories, because there's so many people out here that have the same problem. None of us are 100% healthy mentally all the time, because we live this thing called life. And life, with life comes traumas. And I just want to applaud them. This is just so refreshing to hear, because you hear a lot of doom and gloom. And it doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't.
Mickey, thank you for the phone call. I know multiple guests want to respond. Eric, go ahead first.
Well, one of the things that you're touching on, and I think is really just wonderful, is the advocacy that's now coming from people who have lived experience, who are not simply shying away or covering their tracks, as it were, but are asserting themselves. You know, stigma has been a tremendous challenge in this field. We do a lot of work with suicide prevention and other things, and to get people to sort of come out of the shadows, to be able to step forward and say, look, what I have to say is really important, is fundamental to the field, and it's fundamental to educating professionals. I speak as a professional, and one of the things that I know after doing this for more than 40 years is I've learned more from the people I've worked with as patients than anyone else. And they're not patients anymore. They're often community members, friends, advocates, people I see in the market or at the gym or anywhere else online at the movies. Rochester's a small town, too.
It is a small town. Jordan, what do you think of what you heard from Mickey there, especially when it comes to self-advocacy, support, and a holistic approach?
It's vital. I'll say that when I first started getting treatment, I was a child. And it's really scary when you're so young and the only things that you know, because it's the only thing you're exposed to, is mental health professionals who, in my case, weren't doing the job they should have been doing. As you get older and people are telling you all these solutions, you need to figure out what works for you. And you need to decide that this is the approach I want to take. Sometimes that's not going to be super helpful. I've found some things that I've done to be, you know, not as effective as it could have been. But other times you're going to find solutions that are really, really powerful. So I think that advocacy is for yourself is vital.
All right, let me get an email from a listener named Amanda, who described herself as an artist. And she says that her concern with medication for depression is that she won't be herself. Creative, able to do what she wants to do on a daily basis. And that kind of goes along with a little bit of what we've heard from our guests who had those concerns of, you know, maybe just being in a haze or not feeling all that sharp. And so let me I'll start with Chris Knoll, assistant professor of pharmacy practice at St. John Fisher College's Wegman School of Pharmacy. When someone is voicing this concern, saying, okay, I have a diagnosis of depression, but I'm concerned that I will lose my creativity. I'm concerned that I won't be myself, that my personality will change, that fundamentally I won't feel like me. I hear that concern often, and I understand it. I mean, I've heard it with friends and family. How do we talk through that, and how do we, you know, bring medication into that discussion without making someone feel like you won't be you anymore?
I mean, I think it's all about finding that perfect balance. I mean, just like you two, I'm someone who's also taken antidepressants in the past. I've dealt with depression and generalized anxiety disorder, things like that. And for me, and I think this applies to a lot of people, where I think we're all kind of just on this spectrum of continuous mental health disorders, where you can't just say that you either have it or you don't. Some people have varying forms. Some people have more mild forms. Some people have very severe forms. And I think it's all about finding that right balance because, you know, I kind of see what she's saying, and I felt that way too, where when I was taking them, you know, I was like, okay, like I'm not really depressed or anxious anymore, but I'm not feeling emotions like I was either. I'm just kind of more flat. Like I don't really care about things like I do. I don't get as excited about things as I used to. So very valid concern. And for my case specifically, and this is different for everybody, but for me, it was more like a tool to use for a short time and say, okay, this is how, you know, I can feel on these, and I'm going to try to, obviously, with my doctor to go off of these and see if I can apply these thoughts that I'm having on the medication, not on them going forward. But yeah, that's a valid concern. It's all about finding that right balance.
Okay. So this is really, I think, an important topic, but I view that concern as a side effect in the sense that when I'm not treating patients now, but I did for many years and saw many with depression, and we would talk about dulling as one of the potential side effects, not as extreme as some of the others. And that then becomes a target for your attention for repeated questioning because you may change the medication. It's important to know that severe depression, of course, is one of the things that fundamentally cripples people from being themselves. Their thinking slows down. They are, you know, they're preoccupied with negative thoughts, maybe suicidal thoughts. Their memory may not work as well. And so some people, just the opposite, say, I'm finally myself. And what you're really trying to do is work as a partnership to not only understand what's going on in someone's life and understand their prior exposures, because I use the exposure to medicine as a, you know, exposure to a chemical compound, but also what is the right medication, or as Chris talks about, the right balance for this particular person. There are a huge array of antidepressant medications. When I started, there were 5. I'm not even sure how many there are. What, 30 now or something of that sort? Probably. You know, and so it's very clear that there are some chemical differences, even when they're in the so-called same class. And you really need to understand that for some people, they may respond very differently. And it's incumbent upon the team of the physician, you know, I speak from the physician's role, the advocate, self-advocate patient, the family members when they're involved, to really try to find what is working best and be very honest about it. When it's not, then change it.
Jordan and Eleni, let's talk about your experience and that feeling. So Jordan,
yeah,
I know you want to jump in there too.
Yeah. When I started just recently, I actually asked all my friends to, like, let me know if I'm becoming a jerk, if my personality is changing to a degree that, like, this is bad. Today is my 30th day on antidepressants, and I've noticed just a massive positive change in terms of my motivation and all the things. It's not that it stifled my creativity. I go on stage, I write, I'm a pretty creative person. What I found is it's increasing my energy levels. It's making it easier for me to be able to express my creative side. It's really exciting, to be honest.
So in many ways, this is where Eric Kane is sort of flipping that concern on its head, or not flipping on its head, but pointing out that while it's absolutely valid for some to be concerned or to say this medication really sort of put me in a malaise. I didn't feel like myself. Many other people will say, I'm finally feeling like myself. Mm-hmm, and it sounds like that's more you in this case.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. Everything that was holding me back, I feel like, in terms of just low energy, all the fear and anxiety and things that were going along with a PTSD diagnosis, aren't nearly as pressing as they used to be. So I am able to do things that I love more often, which sounds a little bit like a commercial, but it's interesting.
No, it's great.
It's great, yeah.
That's great to hear. Lenny, what about you?
Well, I really wanted to speak on this because prior to my psychology degree, I was a design student, and I made a lot of fine art, graphic art, and obviously, you know, with the depression, it's really hard to have that attention, that focus. You know, school was very difficult for me, especially in a rigorous curriculum, but you know, I still kind of did my work as a kind of pushing me to be something therapeutic for me. But most of my work consisted of, you know, very emotional type of work from what I was feeling during the depression. And, you know, as it progressively got worse, I stopped doing the work. And I did notice, you know, when I went back on the antidepressants, that I had a little bit of a boost. You know, like Jordan was saying, with Wellbutrin, when I was taking Wellbutrin, most people respond with high energy and, you know, being able to focus more. A lot of times with ADHD, you know, it can also help. So that was a good help for me. It didn't, you know, give me remission and depression, which is, you know, the goal for me. Mm-hmm. But it did help with my energy and my focus and things like that. So I don't think that it's going to take away the creativity. And if it has, you know, keep going and try something else. Chances are, you may just still be in the depression, you know, which is going to give you a lack of creativity.
Okay, Eric?
So we're, you know, talking about in some ways being at the edge of what we know and what we don't know. And I think it's really important to be honest about that. You know, in cancer therapy now, you know, they're doing all this looking at people's genes and trying to understand their immune processes and what's specific to this person. In, you know, all lung cancers aren't the same, all pancreatic cancers or melanoma. And we're just on the frontier of that in terms of medications and the use for depression and that sort of thing. So there's promise in the next 10 or 20 years for that sort of improvement. But that doesn't mean now we can't, as I say, within a partnership, work our way through and find medicines that are more helpful. They may not be perfect, but they allow people who are suffering to improve substantially and get back to life and take part in life, or to use the psychotherapy that was so hard to use when their thinking was slow. So one of the things that I'm concerned about this book is it was so discouraging in some ways, even though it argued for, you call it integrative or holistic approaches. You don't drop a bomb on one of those approaches as you're starting to talk about promoting the other parts. And I think one of the things that we're saying is that, you know, there are a lot of ways that people can find hope. Early on, the most important thing is to be working with someone who has some mental health expertise, who in fact can provide hope because they've worked with folks in many ways and can say, look, I know it's hard right now, but we're going to stick together. And there is another side to this, and it'll just take us some time to get there. And let's get going.
All right, let me grab a phone call. This is Anne in Penfield. Go ahead, Anne.
Oh, yes. Hi. I'm really glad you're having this discussion today. And I wondered if Dr. King could just talk briefly about the very real and immediate dangers that some people can have from SSRIs. It's called serotonin syndrome. And then there's a chance maybe speak on the problems of polypharmacy drug interactions, but especially serotonin syndrome. And I'll hang up, and I appreciate your program. Thanks.
Thank you, Anne.
Well, I'll make a couple of comments. I want to start on polypharmacy, but then I'm going to, since I've been talking so much, I'm going to push this over to Chris, who knows a lot about serotonin syndrome as well. But very clearly, you're using powerful medications, and we know they change brain chemistry. One of the challenges with using multiple drugs, polypharmacy as some people call it, is that they interact a lot. And not only do they interact in your brain, but they may interact in your liver in terms of how they're broken down and metabolized. So you may end up with blood levels of one compound or another that are far beyond or far lower than you would have expected if you had just given that drug alone. Now, serotonin syndrome is a specific and potentially frightening disorder, and I'll turn it over to Chris.
So yeah, I mean, it's very rare, but it can be serious. So it's you know, maybe happens in 15% of people who overdose on these SSRIs, but regularly taking a serotonergic medication is not going to commonly cause serotonin syndrome. So things that you would look out for would be fever, sweating, muscle jerking, or tremor that can progress to something more serious, and you can have altered mental status and become confused. So that's what you would have to look out for. But again, very, very rare.
Right. And it's an emergency room visit when it occurs.
Absolutely.
Because this is not, if you start seeing somebody who is not himself or herself, they're not clear. They may be sweating bullets. Their movements change. It's important to understand that simply because someone has a mental health problem or sometimes even a very significant psychiatric disorder, they don't look like someone who's going into what we would call a delirium, where their thoughts are all confused or their level of consciousness is changing, or as I say, they're really febrile, really feverish. You know, that's a situation where you say, I don't know what's going on. I'd better to be ignorant than to be overly smart and take him to the emergency room.
All right. I want to get ready to close the program because the hour has gone very quickly as we talk about depression and treating it, with just a couple of points and then maybe some thoughts from our panel, from all the members of our panel on this. First of all, yeah, I happen to be someone who I have I guess you would call it a brain disorder, and I have a family member who has a brain disorder. And when I have an episode, I can talk to people and they say, oh, I'm so sorry for you. You know, stay out of work as much as you need. What can we do for you? And when my family member has an episode because of his brain disorder, people don't really get it. And they're confused about why he's not at work, et cetera. Well, I get migraines and he has depression. And I'm in a category that's a little privileged there because it's easier for people to get their head around a migraine. It's an episode. It'll go away. No one gives me any grief for it. Depression's harder. It's a little bit more abstract. And I'm just hopeful that we can be a little bit more caring. And if we don't have depression, reach out and try to understand and be loving to those who do. Second of all, because we've been talking about medication, one of the questions we often ask our friends and loved ones who are showing signs of depression or maybe have a depression diagnosis, one of the first things we say is, well, are you on meds? And that's not a, I don't think that's a bad question. I think it is a loving question. But let's go beyond that and let's ask what we think we can do for each other. And I'm going to start with Eleni. What can people do beyond that question?
This is a great question because one of the most important things, I think, like we said, self-advocacy, but also social supports. And that support for most people is family. And that's the greatest support you can have because you're so around family all the time. And something for me that worked is, you know, I came from a very traditional family. My parents are immigrants from Greece, and it's not the same. You know, they don't quite get it, like we said. So there's something we have at NAMI, which is National Alliance on Mental Illness. We have a program called Family to Family. And this is a great program that is right now from Wednesdays 6:30 to 9, and my parents signed up for it, and they go over everything with you. They go over different kinds of medications, you know, what to look for, different mental illnesses, depression, bipolar, what they can say to you that would be helpful and what to shy away from that would be more sensitive or not to say and not supportive. So that's something that's really helped me. And like I said, I think doing volunteer work and kind of getting into this field also makes me feel better. And the one thing I get from kids when I'm doing presentations, I do the personal recovery story, and they love that so much better than the stats and slides that we show them before.
That's great. Jordan?
For me personally, if someone talks to me about any kind of mental health issues, I always ask, are you getting help? And that can mean anything from, you know, medication to just therapy. And my first recommendation, if the answer is no, is find someone, a professional you can talk to. I'm always happy to be a support for people, but I don't have the training I would need
Gotcha.
To be that professional person. But that said, especially with things like trauma, it's worthwhile to talk with them, listen to them, hear them, what they're going through, what they're saying. And if it's any sort of PTSD symptoms where they're having these flashbacks and triggers where they're going back in time a little bit, remind them that they're safe. Remind them that they deserve, you know, love and respect and understanding. I do my best to try to be there and listen and hear them out as much as I can and make sure that they're... know they're not alone in that moment.
Yeah, that's great. I like the reframing, by the way. Not are you on meds, but are you... getting help.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's great. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just wanted to go back again to the self-advocacy thing, because I think, you know, like diabetes, high cholesterol, we have blood tests for these things. With depression and any other mental illness, we pretty much have to ask questions. So I'd imagine that a lot of people who are dialing in their prescriptions maybe don't know what measurement-based care is, so they're relying on these old definitions of what should be expected at a treatment. Again, hitting on that statement that remission is the goal of treatment. So something like, for example, the PHQ-9, and Eric, you can speak to this as well, advocating for yourself, if this is not already happening, you know, getting your physician to say, to administer these rating scales to see, like, okay, what number are my symptoms at now, and where should I expect to get them to, and having real numerical values for symptom improvement.
All right, about a minute left. Go ahead, Eric.
Well, that's what, in some sense, Alani was talking about in terms of her own mood rating, and I don't know whether you use an app or you just use your own scale, but, you know, this is all about self-awareness, and this is about, this question of, can you build a partnership that involves the people around you? And one of the things that's a challenge, of course, is that when someone feels embarrassed about having a mental health concern or feeling like they're depressed, and so they hide it, that they keep it away from others, they feel like it's not accepted. And so we're trying to be open, and we're trying to reduce the stigma in such a way that we all can work together.
Wonderful discussion this hour. That's Eric Kane, former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester. Thanks for being here, as always.
Pleasure.
Chris Knoll, Assistant Professor of Pharmacy Practice at St. John Fisher College's Wegman School of Pharmacy. Chris, thanks for being here as
well. Thank you.
Eleni Gogos, mental health activist and a psychology student at RIT. Thank you for being here, Eleni.
Thank you very much.
And Jordan Duby, continued success and good health to you. Thanks for being here to share your story as well.
Always a pleasure.
All right, short break. Much more Connections coming up.